Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to get started so we have time for what should be a really engaging panel. Welcome. I'm Ian Gordon, and I'm the managing editor of Mother Jones Magazine. This is the Immigration Beyond Borders panel. I'm sitting here with Lauren Markham, Francisco Cantu, and Hernan Diaz. Before we get started, I just wanted to let you guys know, if you haven't already silenced your cell phone, please take a moment to do that now. My note said cell phone or pager, but I'm pretty sure none of you had pagers. So, and I did... How's that? Any better? I'll just try to talk louder. Does that work? Okay. If you can't hear me at any point, let me know. All right. I'm glad we turned the volume up because now's the point where I acknowledge our sponsors, including my employer, Mother Jones Magazine. So kind of as a way to introduce our authors today, I'd like to just pose a question to them, and that is, how did you end up writing these books at this point in your lives?
Okay, I'll start. Hi, I'm Lauren Markham. So my book is called The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. And it's a true story. It's a narrative nonfiction book about two young men who kind of grow up, are born in the wake of the Civil War in El Salvador and kind of come of age post-war, at first in this time of hope in El Salvador, and then kind of as time goes on, the sort of buried traumas and seeds of the war spring up, and they kind of come of age in tandem with the rise of the gangs in El Salvador, and they're forced out of their homes, along with, you know, tens and at this point hundreds of thousands of other underage, you know, minors traveling by themselves from Central America and crossing our border. So that's what my book is about. About half of it actually takes place nearby in Oakland, and about half of it takes place kind of in their homes in El Salvador and then on the journey here. And I had been reporting, so I'm a journalist, and I also write some secret fiction. I had been writing about migration for a while. I also work at I have a background in refugee resettlement, and I work at a high school called Oakland International High School, which is down Telegraph that-a-way, a few miles, which is a school for all, it's a public school for newly arrived immigrant youth. And so I had been reporting on unaccompanied minors. I first wrote a story for VQR magazine, and then I wrote another one for Vice magazine about unaccompanied minors, and it was sort of before the story hit big in 2014. So I'd been writing some kind of reported stories, and I kept sort of every time, a lot of times I'll write something and I'll be like, oh, I learned so much, that's so great, and I'll carry that knowledge and what I learned forward to my next project, but with this project I'll sort of shift gears somewhat. But with this, I just kept having more questions about unaccompanied minors and kept wanting to write more and sort of learn more, which is, you know, kind of the secret of journalism. As I don't know if Ian agrees, but it's just like, it's this cool thing where you just get to learn about things and then write about them. So I was planning, just as my second article for Vice was going to press, someone at Oakland International High School, my colleague David, walked into my office and said, we really need to do something about all these kids with upcoming court dates. You know, there are all these kids who are in deportation proceedings. And we were like, wait, I was like, what? So I'd been reporting around this on this issue all around the country, but in my own backyard, in this place where I spent 4 days a week, these kids had been coming sort of without us knowing, under our, we didn't realize that, we knew they were there, but we didn't know they were unaccompanied minors. So it was this weird moment of convergence of sort of my professional life as an educator and my work as a journalist. And that's where the book, that's sort of why this book.
I'm Francisco. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. Okay, good. So my book is called The Line Becomes a River. And to talk about why I wrote this book, kind of have to go very far back. I grew up in Arizona. My mother was a park ranger, so I kind of grew up in deserts and like wild places. And sort of close or orbiting somehow near the border in many ways. And then I, you know, like a lot of kids who grew up in small town America, I like couldn't wait to leave Arizona. And so I left for college, and I went to American University in Washington, D.C. I was convinced I was going to become a diplomat or a politician or something. I was studying international relations. And so I ended up studying border issues. I studied abroad in Mexico. And I think that actually ended up sort of orienting me back toward home. And because I felt as I was studying these issues from a sort of academic standpoint, I began to feel that a lot of the immigration and border security things that I would read about, a lot of that still felt very disconnected from the realities that I knew growing up in Arizona. And so I sort of, you know, I was ready to graduate. I was like 22 years old, and I wanted to go back to Arizona, and I wanted to continue learning about the border. And I was sort of hyper obsessed with like the line itself, like where the actual physical landscape and how this line was drawn across the desert as like a natural landscape. And so I sort of convinced myself, to the great horror of my mother, that like the best way to see this place day in and day out and to be out in it, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and to see it in all of its, ugliness, was to join the Border Patrol. I also felt that that would be a way to get answers. I mean, I had all these questions, I think a lot of the same questions that we're still asking ourselves about immigration and border issues, and I thought this would be like a secret backdoor into understanding this issue. And then I felt like, I looked at it as an extension of my education. I thought I would come away from this experience, after 4 or 5 years, with this sort of like bag of tricks that I could then go on to use to become a policymaker or something like that. But you know, after doing that work, you know, you very quickly are made to put away those questions. The Border Patrol, much like any military or law enforcement position, is designed to sort of obscure your sense of who you are and graft this new identity onto you. And so I ended up, when I finally left the Border Patrol 3.5 years later, I felt that this issue was more complex and vast than I had ever imagined in the first place. I felt that I had been participating in this extremely violent institution, or that I had been participating in, I had been perpetuating, deadly policies. And so I really began writing the book as a way, the writing began for myself as a way of sort of looking back at what I had seen and been part of. And that sort of grew out of that. I went to get an MFA because I wanted to sort of like extend my time and build some structure into the ways that I was looking at and thinking about this. And I also wanted to think about it out on a larger level, right? I wanted to not just think about all the ways I had normalized violence in my own life, but I wanted to start looking more broadly at what are the ways that, in the borderland specifically, but also more generally as a nation, as a population, as a society, that we normalize violence, that we become numb to violence. And so that was really the seed, I think, of this book.
Hello, my name is Hernan Diaz, and there are, I think, two answers to this question, because the book, the idea, the kernel for the book, which is called In the Distance, came to me about 20 years ago, and it took me 6 years to write it after 14 years, obviously, of not writing it. And the book is a novel, briefly put, it's the story of two extremely poor, illiterate boys in Sweden in the late 1840s, early 50s, who are sent to the United States. And they're going to New York, and changing ships, they get separated. And the protagonist ends up here in San Francisco. And he decides to walk across the entire country to get to New York without speaking a word of English or having a cent in his pocket, or really knowing the extent of this country, its nature, or not even knowing that the world is round. This is the degree to which he is lost. And of course, he's going against a big tidal wave going west during the 50s, pioneers, prospectors, and so on. So he's going against the big push west and against sort of the tidal wave of history to some extent. So that is the book. And why in this particular moment? Well, that now this particular moment, like I said, is a very long one for me. It's about 20 years. A lot of things happened in my life during those years, obviously. But for me, it was also a way. This story was a way in which I could triangulate my own biography and my own life, and sort of cipher it and include it in the book. I was born in Argentina and left for Sweden when I was 2 years old during the junta regime. So I grew up in Sweden, and but I've spent most of my life here in the United States. So this story for me was a way in which I could conjugate these three narratives into sort of one strand. The character obviously is Swedish. The book takes place in the United States. It is about the United States, if about anything at all. And also there's a secret undercurrent, which is I thought of this book to a certain extent. It's been compared to a Western, and for a number of reasons, but it's also a gaucho narrative. And that is sort of a secret engine that kept the narrative going to how am I translating that into the novel. So, I don't know, yeah. All right.
It also just was shortlisted, but we just keep saying it won the Pulitzer. So the rest of the program will just be us like fanning Hernan and feeding him grapes, and that's it. That's what we're here for. Just kidding.
Yeah, he's a finalist. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer and for the Pen Faulkner. So give it up for Hernan Diaz. Hernan, I wanted to pick up this conversation about about kind of Westerns and the gaucho kind of narrative to talk a little about genre. That's something that the three of you have been talking about quite a bit. These three have been spending a lot of time together. They've basically done a whole Berkeley tour. They went hiking in Tilden today. I mean, they are the cutest panel here at the festival. And so, you know, I just kind of want to talk a little bit, and maybe, Hernan, you could start us off, is just talk about the limitations of genre and how you kind of conceptualized, you know, writing a non-Western Western.
Right. So I should also, as a full disclosure, say that I'm an academic, and that does things to you and the way in which you read, and sadly the way you write as well. But thinking about genre was not, I mean, it was not obviously accidental or a byproduct of the book. The book is a reflection on genre. And what I discovered as I started writing the book is that the Western is a bizarrely neglected genre in American literature. What I mean by this is not that it's unimportant or that there aren't great Western novels. All I'm saying is the place this tradition occupies in the American canon is extremely marginal. From the place it occupies in academia to In general, there are no canonical Western writers, and the few we can think of are usually referred to as anti-Westerns. But the Western they're writing against is sort of absent, here's a strange thing. The Western whitewashes the most essential and the most awful aspects of American history. The trivialization of violence, the reduction of nature into a mere source of extraction of wealth, blatant racism, machismo, the
genocide.
Fetish of...
Genocide.
Genocide, the fetish of guns, the distrust of the state as an institution. It's all in there. So it should have been the American genre. It did not happen. And I find that mind-boggling and baffling and fascinating. So I thought that sort of hacking into the Western was a way of hacking into these issues that define our history. And I thought I would subvert it as much as I could, beginning with the fact that the character is going east instead of west. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, your book totally sort of destructs the myth of the West, which is the Western, right? The Western is just a perpetuation of myth, right?
Yeah, exactly. And also, there's an important thing, which is most Westerns take place after the Civil War, which is also a very crucial component. Mine is set before the Civil War, and in what at the time was called the unorganized territories. So strictly speaking, this character is not even in the United States, right? Which is also a way in which the hyper-nationalistic drive of the Western is questioned, yeah.
And I think that, I mean, everything that Hernán is saying about the Western or, you know, writing set in the West could be said with just a few adaptations about, you know, border, like writing about the border.
Oh, for sure.
Borderland literature, which is, I think, an odd, like, stepchild of, like, the Western genre. I mean, what you quite often have is you have Westerns that are set on the border. And what you even have today, I think, in our political discourse is sort of a perpetuation of this, where the border is really a convenient backdrop. Like, if you live in the borderlands, I think you most often see, you know, an outside story or outsiders writing about or outsiders being placed on or in the borderlands. And the representation of the landscape and the people that populate the landscape are most often cartoonish. And I think, you know, they're simplifications of people, and they're also simplifications of the cultures, and simplifications of violence and cartoonish representations of violence. But what's interesting to me is that it is convenient to do that, and right now we see how it is politically convenient to do that. So I mean, just, you know, the most in the moment example I can think of is that, you know, we're sending our president is sending National Guard troops to the border, but, you know, crossings are at their lowest level in 40 years. The border is by all measures more secure than it has ever been. Secure for who? And I think, but the border is still a convenient, it is convenient for it to be represented as a landscape of violence. And it is convenient to represent the people who are crossing the border as violent and as criminals. And so you see this being perpetuated.
In the writing of your book then, like, how did you set out to kind of intentionally combat those myths of the borderlands as violent as other in that way?
Well, I think it's hard because one of the questions that, you know, I thought about while writing the book and have even thought more about since the book is out, because, I mean, you never know when you write a book how it will come into the world or if it will come into the world. But, I mean, I think one of the hard things about writing about the West or writing about the border or writing about any sort of marginalized place you know, is that there is violence that we need to be talking about that is happening on the border. And so, you know, how do we write about that violence and grapple with that violence in a way that doesn't perpetuate the cartoonish image of a violent landscape? And so I think, you know, to grapple with the fact that the landscape itself is not inherently violent, right? The desert is most often spoken of in terms of, you know, it is a wasteland, or it is inhospitable, or, you know, the word violent is often used to describe the landscape itself, but the landscape is perfect. It's an ecosystem that is fully functional. But we bring violence to the landscape, and our policy has brought violence to this landscape, and violence that is specifically directed against you know, specific groups of people and the most vulnerable groups of people. You know, our border policy for the last several decades has been one of enforcement through deterrence, whereby we have hired more Border Patrol agents and built fences. For those of you who don't know, there is already 700 miles of fencing and boundary constructed along the border. And so what all of that has served to do is to push crossings out into the most remote parts of the desert, the least inhabited, most rugged places, and that is where people are most likely to lose their lives. And although border crossings continue to drop, the rate of death has remained the same or even increased. And so, you know, we see that we are weaponizing the landscape, right?
Well, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the border is such, I mean, just thinking about this sort of like mythic concept of the West, I absolutely agree that the border is like a perfect setting for myth making and myth sustaining. And that is true of our border. And it's also true, I think, of all borders, because most borders are constructs, they're imaginary. They're just, you know, people going, vroom, like, we'll just call that, you know, that's there and this is here. And I did a story for Harper's about border walls, and there are more border walls being built now than like ever before, which speaks to sort of nationalism sweeping the globe, and also to this myth of sort of like just the myth. Nationalism is a myth too, right? And certainly like the nationalism that we sort of project backward onto like the making of California, or like the building of this country, the building of the West, right? That is something that we, you know, project backward in order to valorize that story. But I was, you know, the story I wrote in Harper's was about this tiny little border fence between Norway and Russia that's like 700 feet long or something, but it was like there was an uproar on both sides, like, we need this fence, because all of these migrants were sort of circumnavigating Europe, going up through Russia and into Arctic Norway and crossing. And there was this uproar about this fence, where some people really wanted it because there's like a nationalist resurgence in Norway as well. And some people, and a lot of people, especially the people who lived there, which is an interesting thing about the border, is that like a lot of times people living at the border are the most opposed to the kind of fence and militarization of their landscape and of their homes. People living there were like, this is completely anti-Norwegian, this fence is an outrage. But it's funny because it's like 600 feet. It's not, you know, it's like through the tundra. It's like not going to do anything. But one of the reasons I wanted to write about that border wall is because it's the perfect screen on which to project. Like, it's just about the myths and the stories we're projecting onto the border, and our ideas of what it means, like what this line means and what it doesn't mean, and what it means to be on one side versus the other. And the wild thing, I'm just like, so borders have a magnetism. I've always, like, any border zone I've ever been to, I always just have this wild feeling of like, first of all, there's sort of an entropy. There's almost a magnetic pull, right, where you just kind of want to go to the border, and you feel like you kind of want to like slip across to the other side somehow. You feel, and when I was in Russia, you know, because I'm all like, in the United States, we're totally inundated with sort of like, Russia is the bad guy and is scary. So I just kept feeling like I might just like accidentally fall into Russia, and then like I'd be a journalist in Russia with no permission, and then I'd be in trouble. But it has that sort of magnetic pull. But the wild thing is, just speaking of landscape, is like, and why is this crazy? I don't know. It just feels, of course it's not crazy, but it feels crazy that like over there looks just the same as over here, right? Like the landscape, it's a concept. It's a complete construct, and the landscape is uninterrupted.
Kind of want to pick up on that thought about landscape, because you all write, you know, so fluidly about physical spaces. And it's a real pleasure to read you guys writing about the desert or about El Salvador and all other place things. You know, and something that struck me about all three books was kind of a sense of isolation that is apparent in all of them. That isolation is both geographical, but also emotional. There's a phrase that stuck out, kind of confinement and vastness, I think was something that Hernan said in an interview that he did. And I just wonder how fundamental to the immigrant experience do you think that sense of isolation is, and why did you incorporate it the way that you did into your works?
That's a good, complex question, and I'm a little weary and worried about making generalizations about the immigrant experience, because it's for all the obvious reasons. How do I answer this? I think I've always been sort of a foreigner everywhere. You know, that is the story of my life. I mean, I lived in Sweden, and I don't look quite Scandinavian. And then in Argentina, I had a Swedish accent as I spoke. And then now I live here, and I also have a funny accent as well. And I wasn't born here. And but I don't think I ever experienced this radical isolation. An intentional hyperbole of that experience of being uprooted and elsewhere and dialed up to the absolute maximum. In the book, for at least two-thirds of the book, the character does not understand what is being said around him. So, and many important things on which his life depends are being said around him, and he does not understand a single word. So that was an important a narrative device, and I was very strict with the point of view, and never wavered. And if he didn't understand, neither do we. I was also interested in this experience of complete, utter, radical isolation in the middle of a complete vastness. So this bizarre conjunction of claustrophobia and at the same time an expanse that again the character thinks is literally endless. So the way I thought of this in a way was as being locked out from reality and not being able to go back in. And again, eventually the character in this radical confinement in immensity ends up actually digging a hole and being devoured by the, this is not the end of the book, and being devoured by the landscape and his own solitude in that landscape. And he lives for a number of years literally in a hole.
I think, like Hernan, I think, you know, I don't want to speak, because there's so many different kinds of immigrant experience. It's hard to make generalizations, but I can speak to what does part of the immigrant experience look like in this specific part of the world that I'm writing about often. What it looks like is that, you know, from the moment someone in El Salvador, say, steps out of their house, or quite often from the moment that they decide to take this journey, their body becomes commodified, like they become a commodity. And that is also rooted in policy that has made it profitable to traffic a human body. So I think I'm thinking about this word, kind of vastness, and the way that can be crushing to the individual. And I think that happens from, like I say, the moment that you leave home, right? You leave your doorstep and you set out on this journey. And then, of course, you know, your body is being commodified, and the threat of violence is real, in perhaps not a new way, but a different way along that journey. And then you reach the United States. Crossing the border is a violent act. I mean, it's a violent thing. There's violence wrapped up in that crossing, and we already talked about that. But that violence, I think, doesn't end, right? Like when you arrive in Oakland, and Lauren writes about this so well, you bring fear with you, right? And fear is being introduced perpetually into your life. It's being sustained in your life, and I think that. You know, Lauren can maybe speak more directly to this, but that fear, I know people that live in parts of Arizona who are afraid to leave their homes, right? People who think that it's within the realm of possibility that a helicopter is going to land in their yard and take them and their children away in the night. And that's a fear that we don't think about as being part of the American experience, right? We don't think about that as being part of the immigrant experience in America, but it absolutely is. And so I think, you know, part of the immigrant experience, and at least in this context, is to be crushed, right? Is to be lost, and is to be erased. And if you are not erased, it is erasure is a distinct likelihood. And you see that with the ways that people who lose their lives crossing the border, their identities are often they have been erased in that act, and they are lost.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to respond to in what you both have said, but you know, fear is fundamentally isolating, and I love this idea of how this notion that you could be simultaneously like stuck in this vastness and feel claustrophobic, because I think that's completely true. Essentially, you're claustrophobic in your own experience and in your own fear, and it's intensely terrifying to be in a vast space and in a vast landscape. But it's interesting because, I mean, landscape is fundamental. I feel like every story I write, landscape is in there. And in fact, it tends to be my way into a story. Like describing the landscape tends to be how I can finally, how I can like start a story, and where I kind of ground it, people's experiences in a particular place at a particular moment. I love the way these two writers write about landscape. And you know, there are the two young men. I don't think this is too much of a spoiler. They get lost in the desert. It's a very common migrant experience. What Paco said is super important. I think we have this idea that once you get across that border in the U.S., you're good. But it's actually much more perilous is getting above kind of the checkpoints. So getting kind of like 100 miles or more north after crossing into the border. You know, there's a big swath of the United States that is incredibly perilous once you're considerably inside the United States. And so these two. They're twin brothers, I should say, and they get lost in the desert, and that's completely terrifying. And it sort of echoes what happens in Hernán's book, too, right? They're these young 17-year-olds who've basically never left their tiny rural farming town in El Salvador. And they're wandering around the desert with another kid who I think is like 19 or something from Honduras. And they get lost and it's horrible and they don't know, you know, and they're terrified of being caught, but also all they want to do is be caught, right? Because, you know, it's like, do I save my life or do I risk my immigration status, which is how people die all the time. So that's an incredibly isolating and terrifying experience for them. But my book opens actually in downtown San Francisco, which is another landscape. And what is fascinating to me and what vexed my editor, what vexed my agent, was this notion that the twin brothers are driving around downtown San Francisco with their older brother, trying to get to their court date. They've arrived 2 hours early, and they can't find the courthouse. They cannot find the courthouse. Turns out, because it's not really a courthouse, it's like a weird, like, high rise. It's like the fourth floor or something of 100 Montgomery Street. But they are totally panicked. They're going to miss their court date, which could mean that they're deported in absentia. It's a hugely high-stakes moment. And they don't stop and ask for directions. And my agent was like, I don't buy it. Like, why didn't they just stop? And I'm like, they just didn't. And my editor's like, I don't know. This doesn't make any sense. Like, it's so important that they get to this thing and they're surrounded by people. And why didn't they stop? And what's so interesting is like this landscape of downtown. It's like 9 a.m. on a Tuesday, right, in downtown San Francisco. And they're stuck and they're lost and they're vitally kind of constitutionally isolated and terrified to ask anybody, even though they're surrounded by people. So it's interesting. I saw it as like sort of a twin to the desert experience, like the sort of opposite, right? But similar feeling of like, I'm awash in a sea of people and I'm terrified to like out myself as a migrant or needing help or just to like use the English that I don't have. So I think that speaks to this isolation, right?
And it's such an opposite sense that they had before they left El Salvador, right? And thinking about what the United States had for them and right. what was pulling them. And, you know, right. that gets so much into this kind of American myth that we've been talking about.
Oh, totally. Like
so much.
Raul, the younger twin, 12 minutes younger, but very much like he's the younger twin. And he said he used to dream, he actually didn't want to come to the United States all that much, but when he pictured his older brother, he would, and where he lived, he pictured buildings and shiny skyscrapers. That's what he pictured. And then all of a sudden, he's in downtown San Francisco, and this sort of iconic image that had been such a mythic portrait of what America meant, and, you know, commerce and fanciness and bigness. It was actually what was sort of terrifying him and isolating him, because they were just these, you know, I think I described them as like vertical coffins, you know, just these massive towering structures that represented his smallness and irrelevance in this space. And so it's like, you know, once you arrive, and we all feel this, right? Like once you arrive at your dream destination, like it's rarely as good as it seemed, right? In our imagination, and the myth of the U.S. is that like on steroids, or the American dream, right?
I love that you drew our attention to that moment, because I think that's another perfect example of I mean, that it was also rooted in fear, right? I mean, you can't ask because that is to reveal yourself right. as the immigrant in
right.
this landscape.
Right.
And I want to talk, I just want to say something real briefly about Hernán's book, is that something that I love and that has stayed with me so much, and I don't think this will spoil anything either, but speaking about the you know, the myth, right? I think like everything that we hold dear about the myth of American history is sort of encountered by the narrator in your book, but the narrator flees it, and I think and everything that he encounters that we hold dear about this myth does immeasurable damage to him, and I think that's why this book is really radical. I mean, I think that's a radical rewriting of it. It's not just an anti-Western or a what is it called, a revisionist Western, but I mean, it's you know, to encounter violence and to encounter, you know, a landscape that is laid to waste, or to be, you know, to be confined, or to have your work or your body used. You know, all of these things, we just obscure this in our history. We obscure the actual, like, soul damage that happens. And I love that the book dwells in that, and that we're never allowed to flee that as that's not part of our story. This is never part of the like list of options that like we think is available to us. And I think it's so important to like encounter a narrator who flees it, and who, as Hernán said, like digs holes in the ground to get away from it.
Lauren, you know, I wanted to kind of circle back to the twins for a minute. You get to see them so up close in this book, and it's just such a unusual and kind of thrilling piece of journalism to really inhabit their lives in some way. I mean, it's just the minute amount of detail. I mean, it's incredible detail, and it's really on a micro scale. We get to see so many things about these young men's lives here in the United States, and then also their families' lives in El Salvador. And it's an incredible piece of journalism. But I want to talk to you a little bit about kind of how you approach the ethics of kind of telling that story. And I know you spend a lot of time at the end. You have kind of a almost like a postscript, like a methodology section, as it were, talking about that. And I wonder if you could kind of just explain a little bit of how you thought about that while you were writing the book, and then maybe afterwards too.
Yeah, so like the ethics of sort of going very deep into people's lives who are not mine, and I should say I'm a white writer. My immigrant heritage is way back, and so absolutely there are all sorts of, and I think this is true of journalism as a form, right? There can be an extractive nature of journalism. We're actually talking about this today, right? In my role at the school, I sometimes get calls that are, so my non-journalistic role, I'll sometimes get calls that's like, hey, do you have any Somalis we can talk to from journalists? You know, or like, hey, we want to talk to kids, you know, and there's this sort of like appropriative, extractive take or sort of method of journalism, which is something I really try to avoid. And something I think a lot about. So yes, there are all sorts of ethical challenges and necessary preoccupations of writing a book like this, where you are very intimately telling the story of two young people. I mean, I should say they were over 18 by the time they agreed. And I'll get back to that in a second. But ultimately, they decided that what I was hearing from a lot of my students. So I had sort of decided I wanted to write a book before the. And Ian and I were actually like some of the only journalists in the U.S. writing about unaccompanied minors before the 2000. I mean, we might remember the 2014, like that summer. All anyone could talk about on the news was like, "Oh, the children flooding across our border," and it's all that. Yeah. What you're going to say. Okay. So I knew that I wanted to write a book before that happened. And then I had all of these students, and it was sort of like, I was essentially working as a social worker. My job changed overnight. I was running around trying to support these young people to find lawyers and to like get to their appointments and stuff. Not just the twins. I meet the twins at the school, but you know, dozens and dozens of other young people. And that's still a big part of my job. But what I was hearing from students that summer with all the news, with all the media, was like I was hearing from students that they felt like they were being misrepresented, that their stories weren't being told fairly or well. And I felt like I kept reading the same story over and over, you know, which is, kind of the like synopsis of my book, which is like when Raul and Ernesto Flores like flee the gangs, like, you know, little did they know. And then they left their country.
Your movie trailer voice
good. Yeah, thanks. No, but that, you know, but that's, but it felt like, so unfortunately that's sort of the jacket copy of my book. But I wanted to do something much more than that. And I felt like the intimate details of life were critical parts of telling someone's story. And that actually just saying, these kids are fleeing gang violence, and either on the one hand they're all MS-13 members, or on the other hand they're all these like model migrants, sad young men and women who are traumatized, and like, and actually there's I'm not really interested in that binary, and I found it really important, like I wanted to show these young men. Because I'm an educator and I spend so much time with adolescents, like bringing alive adolescents and in the context of migration and in the context of trauma and fear and the sort of isolation we've been talking about, it felt really important to show these minute details in this daily life texture in order to bring that to life. And so, sorry, I'm sort of going on and on about this, but I will say that for a long time, I was like, I had had the idea, like, actually, the twins would make a really excellent, it sort of dawned on me, my husband actually forced me to go to a meditation retreat, where what you do is anything besides meditate. So I was like, I have a book idea, and I came up with a book. But that's where I sort of had this idea, and it was 10 days, no, silence. But for so long I talked to colleagues, I talked to other journalists, I talked to my boss, I talked to other educators, and I was really afraid of sort of saying I didn't want the twins to feel forced or coerced, and I didn't want to exploit my relationship with them. Even though I'd written tons of stories where I'd developed really strong relationships and developed trust that I think, and earned trust, and I think rightfully, with the people I was writing about, this was a different thing because I had met them first in this context of essentially, like, not quite a social worker, but essentially. But I also found that my fears about them not being able to make a decision for themselves, I was actually infantilizing them. I finally realized I was actually overthinking the, like, oh, they couldn't possibly make a decision on their own, you know, from their own, from, you know, without mind. Like, they were actually, they had walked to the United States by themselves. You know, like they were completely capable of making that decision. And I was heartened that when I did ask them about it, I said, you don't have to answer now. But they said, one of them, the older twin, he said, yeah, you can write. That's actually great. We'd love that. But there's stuff we're not going to tell you. So just so you know, like right off the bat, there's stuff we won't talk to you about. And I was very heartened that immediately they were setting boundaries with me. I will stop there.
Yeah, I mean, I think my calculation is different. I mean, I guess I should say that, you know, sort of the first two-thirds of this book, it's broken into three parts. The first two-thirds of this book are very much a personal narrative about my time in the Border Patrol. And then the third part, the narrative is sort of slowly given over to this other man's story, who is a friend of mine. And so I guess, I mean, you know, Ian, when you ask that question, I have to, you know, to say quite frankly that, you know, my voice as a former Border Patrol agent, you know, is really the voice of, if you look at this as the narrative of a Border Patrol agent, like this is a narrative of, a member of an oppressive government agency, right? Of an institution that's purpose for existing is to block, which I think, you know, that is oppression. And so, you know, like what value is a narrative that, I mean, I had to think a lot about this, you know, after the book came out, because there was a lot of pressure and conversation saying that, like, this isn't the book that we need to be reading about the border. Like, the voices that we need to be elevating and that we need to be listening to and talking about are the voices of the migrants themselves. And that is something that I profoundly agree with. And so, you know, I found myself thinking, like, what is the value of this story? Like, is this a story that needs to be heard? And I think, what I can say is that my biggest nightmare is that this would be the one book that someone reads about the border. And I think, you know, I've already revealed that I'm a naive and idealistic person in telling all the thoughts that I had about joining the Border Patrol and thinking that I could be some force for good within this agency. And but, you know, the naive thing that you hope as a writer is that your book can participate in a conversation, right? That your book can become part of a conversation. And so, you know, from the perspective of a writer, you know, it's my only hope that this book would be one that leads people to other voices and other people who write about the border, and people who write about the border from the Mexicans' perspective on the other side of the border. And I mean, you know, a lot of the nonfiction research that is included in the book is included in hopes that it will lead a curious reader to those works that are cited. And narratively speaking, from a structural standpoint, the narrative of this book actually mirrors that desire as well, because in the third section of the book, the narrative is given over completely to the story of this man Jose, who was my coworker. We worked together, and then he left the country. No, we worked together after I left the Border Patrol. After I was sort of like trying to distance myself from that work in every way conceivable. I was a barista at a fancy coffee shop, and I was a college student. I grew my hair long. I had a man bun and a beard, and so, you know, I befriended this man, and then he left the country to be with his dying mother, and then he wasn't unable to cross the border again. He was apprehended and deported. And so then, because of my friendship with him, I was seeing for the first time in any intimate way the sort of deportation industrial complex of America, right? And you can read about it all day long, and you can do research about it all day long, but until you see it happen to someone that you know and care about or love, I mean, I think that changes everything. And so, you know, we had maybe a version of the same conversation that Lauren had with the twins. you know, where after a certain point I asked him about writing about his story. And what it did was it sort of changed the way that he spoke to me about his situation, because he was no longer commiserating with a friend about his plight. He was sort of telling me something that he now realized might be communicated to others. And so there was, for the first time I was like, well, maybe someone will listen to my explanation behind why I'm doing what I'm doing. And, you know, this man, Jose, I remember him telling me, like, I understand the laws of the United States. I respect the laws of the United States. The rule of law is why I want to live in the United States and raise my children here and not in Mexico. But my sense of family values, everything that I have ever been brought up to believe as a father, dictates that I will not abandon my children. And I will not, I think he told me, my sons are not dogs to be left in the street. And so, when he explained the calculation to me, it was really, I think he saw the act of crossing the border as an act of civil disobedience. And so I think, to describe that, which our rhetoric is encouraging us to do now more than ever, as a criminal act, right? To describe that calculation as a criminal calculation, and to refer to people who have made that decision as criminals, I think that's unconscionable.
Kind of given the hyper partisan political moment that we're in, and kind of the continued continued attacks, I should say, on not just truthfulness, but like truth itself. I'm interested to hear you all talk about how you kind of did the work necessary to kind of imbue your work with kind of some larger truth. And, Hernan, I was thinking about this because I was reading an interview that you did recently where you talked about kind of, as a fiction writer, this kind of affectation of pulling out details from the past that give a sense of, because I know the name of the type of spur that some cowboy wore in the 1840s, that this is factual information, that what you're reading is true, and that was pretty repellent to you as an idea. And I kind of wonder if you could elaborate on that before we talk.
I don't know if I can elaborate. I can rant, but
please do.
Rant away.
Yes, because it's to some extent a historical novel, or a novel that takes place in the past, 150 years ago or so. A recurrent question is the question about research, and I take issue with that word used in the realm of literature very much. I object to it because research presupposes a series of sort of epistemological moves and protocols that apply to hard sciences and not to literature. And I think at the core of the question about research, there is a deep anxiety about the relationship of literature with truth. And literature is perfectly capable of addressing that in its own terms and with its own means. In a way, what happens, and the spur example is, and I'm going to say it, we were talking about this yesterday, is sort of the... It's not about truth, but the fetish of truth. So that's always the easiest way out, is just to turn a book into some kind of antique store that peddles old lexical tchotchkes, And then that, with those little tokens, with those little objets, you're somehow bribing the reader into believing that this is ye olde. Right. And that, to me, is a problem. But at the same time, I did not want to be anachronistic. So I was very careful not to use words that had been sort of accepted into the English language, or by the Oxford English Dictionary after, say, 1860, but always sort of without being flashy about it, right?
You know, meanwhile, as narrative nonfiction writers, you guys face kind of a different challenge, and I'm wondering how, you know, Paco, your book, obviously, so much of it is about your personal experience, and I'm wondering how you went about kind of digging through that to make sure you were bringing to bear, the true story in those moments, and also how that changed when you were telling someone else's story in the last third of the book.
I think what was important to me as I wrote the book was, well, I guess part of the reason that this was important to me is that the first part of the book, the first section of the book, really the seed for that, it came directly from this journal that I kept during those like first years of doing field work in the Border Patrol. And so when I decided that I needed to, you know, like a 6 months to a year after leaving the Border Patrol, when I first decided to do some writing about it for myself, to put anything down on paper, that was sort of like the one document that I had. And so it was important to me sort of starting with that and like looking at it and encountering it really sort of for the first time, because I wasn't someone that kind of like flipped back through my journal to see what happened yesterday or 2 weeks ago. I was sort of like overwhelmed again a few years later at like an accumulation of encounters. And moments. And so I think what was important to me in the book was not to sanitize those encounters and also not to sanitize or editorialize the way that I was normalizing those encounters or the sort of like twisted logic that was being fed to us to keep us existing in this role. And I mean, I think what's so important about nonfiction from a literary standpoint, nonfiction that, you know, is not just journalism. I mean, I think writing is, the reason it's so important is because writing gives language to something that we might not yet have language for grappling with or understanding. And I think, you know, writing about something, it carves out a space for understanding that thing. And I think quite often with nonfiction, with narrative nonfiction or with memoir, the literature is often revealing something. Like, and this goes to publishing culture, right? Like, what's like a hot manuscript that a publisher is going to buy? Like, oh, the nonfiction that reveals something that's happening far away, out of sight, or in the shadows, right? And so I think that's why, for example, the literature that is written by veterans who are deployed. I mean, because I think there's a parallel here. You know, they're working for an institute, a violent institution. They're being deployed in places far away, and we often turn our attention away from that. And then, you know, like with this sort of slow flow of like Vietnam memoirs that's coming out, that was coming out. You know, here were these people who were going away and then coming back, and like they didn't have a space to reckon with that. And now that is a genre. Like, war memoir is its own genre, but it's sort of a genre that didn't exist in the same way before that. And I think what's interesting to me about the border and the Border Patrol, I mean, like, this isn't a genre. There's no Border Patrol memoir genre that you can dip into. Thank God.
Until now.
But what's interesting about this is that this is happening in plain sight. I think that's what I mean to say. I think what I mean to say is that, like, it's not like I went away and had some transformative experience and was asked to do something terrible far from home. You know, this was happening. This is happening like, I live in Tucson. You know what I mean? It's happening in America on our doorstep, and we don't talk about it, we don't think about it, but really it is like low intensity warfare that we are waging and asking people to participate in
and profiting from greatly. I mean, just quickly on that, your question, I feel like gets to back to this question of genre, right? And I think I find it really difficult to describe my book, even though it's not like such a radical book, but it's sort of, it's journalism, but like literary nonfiction. That sounds sort of, I don't know, that sounds sort of like a, I don't know, I don't, it sounds nice? All right, great. My book is a work of literary nonfiction now.
Oh. No, go. No, I don't want to explain your book
explain
to
it. Your... Please do. Please do.
That's ridiculous.
That would be great.
No, but what I think the sort of the common thread in a way is a care and an attention to language that really separates this kind of writing from others, where the linguistic effect is not just some kind of epiphenomenal froth.
It's central.
Yes.
It is the center.
Yes.
Yeah. Agreed.
And which loops back to the whole relationship to truth,
right,
that literature is able to articulate in a very unique, precise way.
Completely agreed. And this is something we were sort of talking about last night, because I think that in terms of this genre question, with my book, language was central. It is central to everything I want to read and everything I want to write. And like on a sentence level, and I love sentences, and I love making them and thinking about them and reading them, and saying them, clearly. But for the kind of work that I was doing in my book, truth is in the language, but there's also this thing of fact, which, because it is it is doggedly a factual story. And so I had to be grappling with the facts. And I think of the facts as this almost kind of like the skeleton or scaffolding around the rest of the story, which is the truth of the matter, is sort of built in. But of course, and this is also something we were talking about last night, like truth, and this is sort of a controversial thing to say at this moment because of like the assault on truth, right? But truth is, of course, subjective. When we talk about someone's, for example, someone's memory, right? A lot of this book is reconstructed. Me reconstructing stories through the memories as told to me, right? Like, that is so many layers of possibility for it not being, for me not rendering it exactly as it was, but as it was remembered and then filtered through, you know, description. So, yeah.
And, you know, how do you manage kind of both privileging the voices of these young men and their families, right, but also kind of, on the other hand, fact-checking, right, memories that...
Right. Right.
Exists in the ether.
I tried to as much as possible, you know, and there were lots of times where like one family remembered it this way and another family remembered it that way. And in that case, I would sort of say, he remembered it this way and this other person remembered it that way. But I also, it's like, I wanted to also take, I would ask them again and again. So I interviewed them again and again, to see if their story was changing, in case that there was some sort of like factual discrepancy there, but more because, you know, our stories all change, right? I mean, like the way I will talk about my book today will be different from the way I will talk about it in a year. The way I will remember a moment from my childhood when I'm 10 will be different from when I how I remember it now. So that is just, I think, and this is the sort of the fetishizing of fact that we're talking about, like that fundamentally is at odds with all of our experiences of living, which is not to say that true facts don't happen in our lives, but that all of our lives and what happens to us is filtered through our experiences and perceptions of them.
Yeah, but also acknowledging opacity and distortion as an essential part of any attempt at telling the truth. It would be naive to pretend that wasn't a part of it. Yeah. There is interference always.
I also think that all three of these books, I should maybe just speak for my own book specifically, but I think this is probably true of all three books, that I think these books are less interested in telling the reader a truth, right, than they are in asking a reader to inhabit a question, right?
And a world.
And a world, right? And I think that if a reader is asked to do a little bit of work, right? Like if we're asking readers to participate in inhabiting a story, I think the conclusions, I mean, this isn't always going to work, but like quite often the conclusions that someone is going to reach on their own, that's going to stay with them more, and that will, you know, you internalize that, I think, in a different way than you do when you read, I mean, that's why literature, like the question, why literature? Otherwise, you just read facts in a newspaper. But I think, you know, we read literature because we inhabit a story and we feel it.
Yeah, and being told what to think isn't that pleasant, right? I mean, being told what to think about something.
It's not.
No, it's really not that.
It depends who's telling you.
Yeah.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and I think now's a great time for audience questions. Not quite sure. I think we should just yell them out.
There is a microphone.
Oh, you got a mic. Never mind. Ignore me. Please wait for a mic.
Oh, there are two mics.
Two mics. I think there's a mic going over there.
Just yell them out. He's an amateur. Can you hear me?
And learn from my mistakes. Speak loudly.
Can you hear me if I do this?
Yeah. Yes.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, great. So this is a question from a man who worked in a building that shared a wall with 100 Sutter. And if I had bumped into those young men, I would have said, what courtroom? Okay, so I kind of get what you're driving at. You never would guess being there could happen. Right. I'd like to ask a question about what I think is the elephant in the room, or at least in my room, and you guys are endeavoring to come to grips with something which is horrific, right? What do you think catalyzes a discussion in this country to deal with this issue of an immigrant population, a non-citizen population, which is incredibly important to this country, big contributors, making a big difference in helping us move forward in the future, in my opinion, but we just can't get into a dialogue that's anything other than temporary Band-Aid solutions. Yeah. If you get the gist of what I'm trying to get at, where they're your imaginative, creative people, what gets us talking about it in a way that makes some changes that stick for a little while, as opposed to having to renew something every 2 years and hope that it works?
Well, I think like a short and very general answer would be that, like, if you're asking the three of us, like, we believe that telling stories is like kind of the only way to gradually chip away or shift this momentum.
And to get out of the rut of the narrative that we're fed and sort of, you know, which is essentially criminalizing and weaponizing and commodifying migrants, right?
Right, and in your question, you allude to this, that in this country, well, in many countries, right? I mean, we have this long-standing system of sort of beckoning people with one hand and asking them really to come, and then with the other hand, simultaneously pushing them away, or at least when they are no longer of use, or when you know, depending on the region, you know, when the flames of nationalism are stoked, then now leave. But I think you owe a moral obligation to the people that you have invited into your home, right?
Yeah,
and also, what is a home? I mean, I also think that this is more myth-making. But I think, I was listening to, we mentioned this on our walk today, I was listening to a podcast, the writer Derek Jensen, who I think is a Bay Area or a Northern California sort of like radical environmentalist, and he talks about... In talking about environmentalism, like saving the planet, right? He talks about the need to sort of shift our allegiance away from this sort of like the myth of consumptive capitalism, where like growth is the only thing, and shifting that away towards like being loyal to the idea of to the landscape and to the plants and animals that inhabit it, so that, you know, when another species goes extinct, like, that you feel that deeply, right? And that you feel a loss, and that will shift the way, that's the only thing that will shift the way you make a decision, right? Is if you feel more loyal to the environment than you do to like the need to buy something. And so, I mean, I think that you could pretty easily adapt that to the way that we think about migration and border issues, right? Like, we are more loyal right now to the myth of nationhood and these laws, right, that can be changed. That's the thing. Like, the laws can be changed. And we are more loyal to that nationalistic idea than we are to the human lives that we're talking about.
You know, one thing that occurred to me is if stories are the answer in a lot of ways, as you guys are saying, it's like, how do we get those stories into the hands of the people who need to hear them the most?
Which is unfortunately like harder than ever to imagine, like at this moment in time, right?
Well, I'll say one other thing is like maybe you trick those people. Yeah. And I said this yesterday, kind of like for the first time in a panel, but like we've sort of talked about it. And like I think Hernán's book in a way tricks the reader and you're talking about how that can sometimes be a problem, right? Because like a reader might come to that book expecting a Western. But then when you know, if the reader sincerely engages with the work, then they come away with something quite different. And if they internalize anything about the book, they're internalizing a very different narrative than the myth of the American West. And I think, you know, in my case, like, I think there's a lot of people who might pick up my book because it's written by a Border Patrol agent. Hell yeah, you know, like, I'll read that. Like, you know, but the story that you come away with is quite different, you know, that it's not a build-the-wall narrative. And I think that, I don't know, maybe we just have to be more sneaky about, like, how we get stories.
We need to, like, wrap our books in, like, different jacket covers or something. But I just want to say, I agree. I think actually, I love Hernán's book because it's fabulous. I love both of these books. But I think that it's important to look backward at history because the conversation we have about migration is as if it started like yesterday, which is so bizarre. There is a long historical precedent and dynamic of migration where there is always a criminalized and sort of maligned newcomer. And now our newcomers happen to be brown people, which makes it easier to criminalize and weaponize them. Who's in charge here?
I don't know. This question, is this on?
Yes.
This is a question for you, Francisco. I was wondering how your book was received by fellow border or other Border Patrol people.
Broadly, I'm not a popular figure within the Border Patrol culture, which is okay. I think that's fine, and I've always expected that. I do think that people will encounter the book. I mean, I wonder, like, if I had encountered my book, like, as a Border Patrol agent, maybe what I would have thought of it. I don't know. But I think it would be something very different than I would think of it now or than I would think of it after having done that work. I mean, my hope is that there will be people who have left that work behind. And it should be said that people leave that work behind all the time. The turnover rate in the Border Patrol is like the highest of, like, maybe not, I think it's maybe like the highest of any federal law enforcement agency. You know, people leave that job. The suicide rate is also high. And so I think, you know, I hope that, you know, I hope that it opens up space to talking about, and this is, you know, I mentioned the genre of like war literature, right? I think which was so important in opening up a space where like we now talk about like post-traumatic stress disorder, and we now talk about, you know, a lot of things about the experience of being sent to war and trained for war that we didn't talk about before. And really the language that's used in the Border Patrol and the mentality that it is the language of warfare. You're given the mentality of warfare.
They're invaders, right?
Right.
Invaders.
Yes. And like instead of, you know, you're not given, the word is an enemy, but it is criminal, you know, which is a small distinction. And so I think that, you know, I hope that it's a book that people would encounter after like leaving that work behind, and that it would resonate with them. I can say that some of the people who I'm friends with who were in the Border Patrol or who are in the book, I shared the book with them, and one of the first things that they always say, or one of the few things that's in common with everyone I've heard back from, is, you know, they always say like, oh wow, man, I didn't know you were going through such a hard time. I didn't realize that. But that's because there's not a culture of talking about, I mean, it's a toxically masculine culture of not talking about your feelings and performing callousness as opposed to making yourself vulnerable and grappling with, you know, the ways you're being asked to set aside your sense of morals and ethics and humanity, right?
Absolutely. I know we could keep this conversation going for hours. In fact, these three will probably go on another hike later and continue doing that.
Thinking of starting like a reality show.
Would you guys watch that? We just go eat and drink places.
Intergenerational
and talk about stuff?
Writers, some narrative.
Poor
I don't know. Anyway, so our writers are going to be in the lobby signing their books. Please feel free to go get your book signed. Go get a
thank
book.
You.
Get it signed, and also, you know, to continue the conversation with them. Please join me in thanking Hernan, Francisco, and Lauren.
And thank you to Ian, our amazing wrangler.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.